this morning is Dr. Lee Shiver, friend and neighbor. Dr. Shiver's career as a professional educator spanned 39 years in several locations in Florida and Georgia. He served as a teacher, researcher, elementary and high school principal, school system superintendent, and state-level education department official, including service as Pickens County Superintendent of Schools from 1999 to 2005, and as director of the Georgia School for the Deaf from 2006 to 2011. He earned his BA in education and a master's degree and doctorate in education administration at the University of Florida. An acclaimed innovator and change agent whose results are well documented, Dr. Shiver understands that law and policy must be grounded in our values and that responsible leaders use our values to steer the law and policy formulation process. Dr. Shiver and his wife, Carrie, who is also a retired teacher, live in Jasper, Georgia, just around the corner from Gale and friends. Title of Dr. Shiver's presentation this morning is Do Something. See?
Thanks, Bruce. Good morning.
Good morning.
When I read Bruce's write-up about this service in the paper, the Pickens Progress, I gotta go hear this guy. That's gonna be really good. Put the pressure on. I know I don't look like it, but I am a 3 month old. I met Max the second day planet, and I went to see him in the hospital. I took Max in my arms, and I had a private conversation with him. Remember to call me Pappy. That was the name I had selected, and that's from growing up with Popeye. His dad was Pappy, and of course, Little Abner's dad was one of those guys. But I talked to Max, and I held him in my arms, and I walked away from his mother, and was going to be Mimsy, and they thought I was going out in the hallway with him, but I held him in my arms, and I told him what I was concerned about, and I told him what I was doing, and I told him why I was doing it, and told him he was receptive, and good conversation for one side. I never knew my own personal philosophy about things was aligned with the seven principles of, I didn't know that. Unfortunately, my message this morning is not light, but I know it is true and right and important. I was happily retired. I'd moved back to Jasper. Carrie retired last year. Things were going great. Changed my whole lifestyle. Sleeping late, drinking in the middle of the week. I mean, it's just a whole different deal there. And I was really, really enjoying it. We went on a road trip last year to Key West, and she had never been. I had never been, and we had a great time. And I got called up with an old fraternity brother of mine from university, and I had rediscovered Mark online accidentally, trying to reconnect, because you know, whatever happened to, and I found him online, and there was a story. First thing that came up on Google was a story about him being arrested, his arrest record, for feeding the homeless in violation of the Fort Lauderdale City Ordinance. Mark, it turns out, is an Episcopal priest in Coral Springs, and is just as surprised about my career as an old fraternity brother being a school principal and superintendent as I was about Mark becoming a priest. We had a great time. I hadn't seen Mark in almost 40 years. We went out to dinner, went on our trip, started staying in touch on Facebook. In February, on Mark's Facebook page, he posted something that unnerved me. He basically described how he had to perform the funeral of one of the kids who had been killed at Douglas High School in Parkland, 16-year-old girl who had son. And Mark said it was the hardest thing he had ever done. So I read that and I tried to compose something sympathetic, something supportive, and send it to him. And I did. sent me back a private message not long after that, however, said that was not the hardest thing he had ever done. The hardest thing he had ever done was when he had to go to the morgue to perform this religious sacrifice over this girl's body. And he said that the side of her head was a wound the size of this baseball, a hole in her head, with her skull to the back. And I did not know how to respond to that. It took me a few days. And then I couldn't stop thinking about it. And it bothered me a lot. And I was reading about it and thinking about it. And so I decided, I'm not sure what I can do, but I'm going down to see my representative in Atlanta. I was warmly received. The meeting started off well, but it was in his private office. And I said, I want to know what you're going to do, what you intend to do about these guns, these masks. And he wanted to start talking about, no, I want to talk specifically about these kinds of guns. That's what I want to know. Now, I did not know his background, his history. I've known him since 99 when I first moved to Jasper. He was a good guy. I considered him to be a friend of mine. But I didn't know his stance for all this. I didn't know he was A-rated by the NRA. I didn't know any of that. So I'm talking to him, and he says, Lee, there's nothing practical to be done. And I had a really hard time with that, sitting there, keeping my composure. And I said, and then he wanted to start, I said, look, don't patronize me. You know me. I said, I'm looking you in the eye, and I'm asking you, what would you have done if this had happened in high school? What would you be doing differently today if 17 teenagers? So I get shaky talking about it and thinking about it. And I got up, I shook his hands, I said, thank you for your time. I can't believe this. I said, I know and I believe you're going to do something. So I went home and talked to my wife, and she just looked at me because she knew I was having such a good time being retired and not going to school board meetings and not thinking about all the crazy things that you think about when you do something like being a school principal or a teacher or any of the other things I've done. And we talked and talked and talked, and I started thinking about things. And I was principal of Tipton County High School in 1999 in Columbine. And I remember what happened the next day at that school, what I had to deal with, and how people and students were scared. And the whole day was just discombobulated. And I had a couple of wiseacres show up in trench coats the next day. I remember this, and I remember my conversation with them, what we did. I mean, it was tough. I remember when I was the director of the Georgia School for the Deaf, when the Virginia Tech massacre happened, and those kids, all deaf and hard of hearing, and most of the staff were deaf and hard of hearing, were so shaken. We had a big campus over in Cave Spring, hundreds of miles from, and I thought about them and their reactions and their fear, their sadness. I ended my career as an elementary principal in Albany, Georgia. I had an all-black elementary school for. When Sandy Hook happened, my assistant principal and my secretary were so worried about me because I went into my office, and I was always open door guy, always out in the hallways, always talking to kids, doing what I thought principals did. And I got in my office and closed the door and could not come out. I could not regain my composure. So I thought about those kids, and I thought to myself, happily retired, I'm comfortable, I'm having a great time, but I got to do. Over my career, I certainly learned tolerance and to accept the differences in others and to respect different opinions and those who believe otherwise. But I was determined to learn and to keep on learning about what could be done and what I could do about the easy accessibility and lethality of these weapons, these guns, when we least expected. The more I read, the more people I talked with and listened to, the more convinced I became of our shared values, especially our children's lives, our collective futures, what we really want America to look like. The feeling of safety we used to have when we would go out to concerts or to the Apple Festival or the Marvel Festival or go to the movie theater or to a restaurant or to any place where lots of people were gathered. Instead of going out now and looking around at LA elevated windows and skylines and trees and bushes and thinking about, okay, if something happens, where do we go? What do we do? How do we, what's the easiest way to get out of this one? I don't think we should be thinking about that. I don't think that's where we should be in this country now. This is the 16th church I've been to in 16 consecutive Sundays. I didn't speak with anybody except to the pastor after the service. Four of those churches, at least four, had deacons standing in the back of the church armed. I could see the bulge on their hips. And I spoke to the pastors about it. It didn't used to be this way, and it doesn't have to be this way now. One early defender I had a conversation with who was defending the Georgia's gun laws as they currently are, said, any change in the laws is always going for the same thing. The end game is always the confiscation of all guns. And I said, it's been 242 years, and that ain't so. That's not going to happen. And I reminded him of the United States Supreme Court case in 2008, D.C. versus Heller, in which the U.S. Supreme Court actually said, yes, individuals do have a right to bear arms. You have a right to have a gun. But it also said, you do not have a right to have any kind of gun for any purpose whatsoever to carry with you and do with whatever you want to do it with. That was Justice Scalia and his decision. Of course, the guy I'm talking to has never heard of this. And the reason he's never heard of this is because that's not what the gun lobby perpetuates. That's not what it's a continuous fear item of, they're going to come take your guns, take your guns. So I've been talking to a lot of different people, and I've heard more than once, guns don't kill, people kill. Billions of people have access to gasoline and matches. Billions. But they don't run around setting each other on fire. I read Facebook posts asking me why I didn't want to ban all cars, because they kill thousands of people every year. And I had explained gently, without sarcasm, without being facetious, without calling names and trying to be civil about it, that the people behind the wheels of those cars are not intending to kill as many people as they can in a shorter period of time as they can. Mass shootings are not going away. They're getting worse. In fact, three of the deadliest mass shootings in U.S. history have occurred in the last 10 months. And last night in New Orleans, three were killed, seven were injured. The data, the stat people don't count that one because four people didn't die. I heard criminals don't obey laws. There's no need of you trying to suggest we do something because criminals don't obey laws. And so I said, well, then why do we have any laws? What about the people out here on 515 on our tails at 75 miles an hour, tailgating and speeding and weaving in and out of traffic? And what did we do back in the 60s and 70s? Most of you in here remember the carnage created by drunk drivers. We changed the law to protect us on our highways. And the number of people killed in drunk driving accidents has dropped precipitously. We've saved tens of thousands of lives because of drunk driving laws. I got a guy telling me the assault weapons ban of 1994 didn't work. He said, there have been studies. He said, this study came out and said there was no reduction in gun violence after the ban, or during the ban. What he didn't say was the number and frequency of mass shootings declined during the 10-year gun ban from 1994 to 2004. After the ban was lifted, after it was allowed to expire, the number and frequency of mass shootings has more than doubled. And the thing about these mass shootings now, it's not five people, six people, eight people. It's 17, 16, 23, 24 in a church in Texas. The Vegas shooter, 58, injured over 600 people. Another guy said, oh man, come on, this is all about mental health. And I said, being angry and hateful is not mentally ill. Or one preacher, it's the book called Moral Combat, in which a couple of researchers who are also professors at two different universities have all the supporting data to show that there is no link between the millions of people that play violent video games and mass shooters. As a matter of fact, it pointed out that most of the mass shooters are loners. They do not participate in social activities sitting around playing these games. And it was really, really interesting. It's a great book. I highly recommend it to you, Moral Combat. The blame goes on, the blame game goes on in Georgia, except for the role of guns. There are now school safety committees that have come out of the House of Representatives and the Georgia Senate. They're meeting all over the state. Bruce and I attended one up in Ringgold the other day. I was at the one in Sandy Springs, studying school safety as if this is a response. Ladies and gentlemen, we have been studying school safety in this country since 1957, when President Eisenhower called in federal troops to Little Rock, Arkansas, to get desegregation in the South started. We have been studying school safety. I was on many, many school safety teams way before Columbine. We can study, but studying something is not doing something. When I was at the House Committee meeting, excuse me, Senate Committee meeting, Safety Committee meeting in Sandy Springs last month, the Sandy Springs police chief, in addressing the senators on this committee, said, talking about school safety without talking about gun legislation, it's like talking about the Civil War without mentioning slavery. I know when it comes to controversial issues like this one, the moral force of people who care is often much stronger and more powerful than the political force. Perhaps the gun lobby and the defenders of the status quo are hoping and praying that nothing terrible happens in Georgia. Maybe they're wishing that the next mass murderer will use a vehicle or a knife or a bomb instead of a gun to kill us when we least expect it. Instead of a gun that could have been prohibited from being owned by a domestic abuser. Instead of a gun that could have been taken away by a local judge from a non-threatening person by a red flag law. Instead of a gun with a magazine holding no more than 10 rounds, which would limit the number of dead and wounded. Instead of a gun that wouldn't have been privately sold if the owner had been required to accompany the prospective buyer to a local gun shop to run a background check. Instead of a gun in locked storage that was inaccessible to anyone but the owner. Instead of a gun with a bump stock. Instead of a gun legally purchased by a hateful teenager. Instead of a gun purchased by an angry man who never got the chance to cool off during a required waiting period. Instead of a gun that couldn't have been fired had it been equipped with a trigger lock. Instead of a gun that would have been illegal to purchase or possess under an assault weapons ban. There's lots more. There's lots more. Today we can do something. Something that matters. Something that will help reduce the growing number and frequency of mass shootings. Something that will allow us to reclaim our freedom from fear. We've done it before. In 1929, that was the year of the original St. Valentine's Day Massacre. I wasn't around. Seven mobsters gunned down in a Chicago garage, their bullet-riddled bodies lying in pools of blood on the floor. In 1929, though, the newspapers and magazines all over this country took those photographs and they published them, and they went out all over the nation. It shocked the national conscience. People could not believe what they were looking at. It was so awful, so horrific, so horrible. 5 years later, Congress passed the National Firearms Act of 1934, specifically to outlaw the weapon used by those gangsters, the Thompson submachine gun, also known as the Tommy gun. That was in 1934. I wondered. And please forgive me, please. I wondered, would I even know Bruce, or would I be standing here today, if after the Sandy Hook massacre, that the photographs of those children with the holes in their bodies and their heads had been published in all the newspapers and all the magazines and on all the social media and all the television networks all over the country, if we would even be talking about this. Would we not have responded in a way that we did in 1929 and said, we're not having this anymore? But somehow our morality about what's right and what's wrong has gotten crossways with the things that we truly believe. So we don't do that. Is there a national conscience anymore? I believe there is.
know that's hard. I believe we can and we will change to bring about a peaceful, fair, and free world. I believe that far too many of the people who represent us under the Gold Dome in Atlanta are overly concerned that proposing or supporting any change in Georgia's gun laws would jeopardize their support from the NRA or perhaps bring a lawsuit from what, in fact, is our country's most powerful social welfare organization. If our worst nightmare hit too close, would any of the pro-gun legislators rush to change current gun laws to help make us safer? Or would they wait to see how much pressure they felt from their constituents? What would they say in the horrible, grief-filled aftermath with a microphone stuck in their face as the cameras rolled and the phones recorded? What if the body count included someone they knew or their child? It's always been interesting to me when people who, for mostly political reasons, claim to hold different values about the sanctity of life and who lay claim to a higher moral ground of individual rights over the common good, when these same fervent people suddenly change, why should we wait? I don't want Max to ever have to think or worry about any of this. I hope he never will, but I do hope he'll come happy.